Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report, chatting with Mark Chandler. We're going to be talking about some of the key currency moves this week, as well as looking ahead to next week with US jobs data and the Fed meeting. Mark is the managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also editor of the Mark to Market website. Now, Mark, starting off on the currency front, we haven't talked much about currencies this week, but you look at something like the dollar on the dollar index, it's over 106 right now. It's more or less kind of leveled out after a run in kind of the second week, I think it was, in April. But look, this is still a pretty strong level for the dollar. We all know that the dollar is measured against a basket of currencies. What stood out to you in terms of currency moves this week that has kept the dollar stronger?
Sure. So the big news in the currency market's really been the dollar yen. The dollar has made new highs as we enter the, you know, to get ready for the weekend. The dollar is at almost 157.80. Now, we haven't seen that in a generation. And by a generation, I mean not since Q2 of 1990. It was the last time dollar yen was at these levels. And ironically, there's been very little pushback. You know, typically when the yen is weakens, you get some cries from U.S. protectionists about how it's an unfair subsidy for Japanese producers. But most of the U.S. protectionist angst is aimed at China these days, not Japan. And even in Japan, the Bank of Japan had an opportunity to voice its objections, but it didn't. Today, when the BOJ met earlier, they actually revised lower their inflation forecast for this fiscal year. And, you know, in Japan, it's the Ministry of Finance's call about intervention. And the Ministry of Finance simply says that when it's appropriate, that they'll take action. So since they haven't taken action, it means that they don't think it's appropriate yet. The market has this idea in its head that there's some kind of red line that they're defending. First, it was going to be 152. Then it was going to be 155. Then 156 and a half. And here we are at 157.80 almost. No sign of intervention. So what made the intervention successful or effective last time they intervened in September, October 2022? The two things. One is the Bank of Japan, when they do intervene, they try to like overwhelm the market. In those September, October 2022 operations, they spent $60 billion. They sold roughly $60 billion and bought the yen. But what made it effective, though, wasn't so much the size. I would suggest that it was because they picked a top to the U.S. yields. And yet with the higher-than-expected inflation readings we've had on GDP this week and on the personal consumption expenditure deflators, which the Fed targets, with the higher inflation numbers, you would think that the stronger dollar is very much in the U.S. interest as it helps fight inflation. So what that means is that the Japanese can't be confident that they can pick a top in U.S. yields, especially this side of the FOMC meeting and the U.S. jobs data next Friday.
Well, Mark, just following up on the yen and some of what Governor Ayuda has mentioned, to your point, they don't seem like they're in a hurry to do anything in an urgent sense, and they're kind of sounding like the Fed in the sense that the Bank of Japan was saying that they would act based on the price developments in the economy and, you know, what they see. So basically a data-dependent answer. But it's going to have to be something that they face because the public of Japan is seeing higher inflation. It's not bad. And they're saying it's the government saying it's not bad. But a lot of people in Japan are saying as the yen continues to weaken, everything else is going up in price for them. So how do you think they square that circle with people facing higher inflation and their desire to kind of wait and be data dependent?
Yeah, so I think you're right. The political fallout is not necessarily good, but the Japanese stock market is having a good, so the weakness of the yen sort of more or less helps bolster Japanese stocks. And you think about the Japanese stock market, the Nikkei is up roughly 13, almost 13.5% this year. But it's true what you say, I think, that the Prime Minister Kishida is unpopular. His support is low. There's three by-elections coming up in the next few days. And, you know, the Liberal Democratic Party, who's basically run Japan for more than half a century, is unpopular. And they're not even fielding candidates in two out of the three prefectures that have elections. So the real issue for Japan, the fallout that you speak of, political fallout. There's going to be a leadership. There's a leadership challenge opportunity later this fall in September, and we'll see what we'll see if there's a leadership challenge. But you're right that the Prime Minister Kishida, his cabinet, have a very low level of support. But I'd say that the economic fallout from the weakness of the yen seems pretty limited. It's true that JGB yields have risen, but we're talking about rising Japanese yields. We're talking about a 10-year bond yield that's below 90 basis points. I don't think we get too worried about Japanese yields rising as they would in other countries to compensate for the weaker currency. As I mentioned, the Bank of Japan lowered their inflation forecast for this fiscal year today, despite the weakness of the yen. So I kind of think that on one hand, it'd be like John Connolly said about the U.S. back in the 60s. He said, our currency, your problem. And if Japan's problem with the yen, it seems to be mostly giving verbal support without having to do anything materially. And partly, I think, is because the downside, the negative consequences seem quite limited still.
Mark, let's bring it back to the U.S. then and recap some of the data, economic data from this week. GDP came in quite a bit lower than expectations, showing a slowdown in the economy, but it was still a positive number. So take that what you want. And then the PCE number, inflation, when we saw the PCE deflator in the GDP number, it was much higher than expectations. But then we got the PCE data on Friday, and that was more in line with inflation expectations. How do you take this reading in terms of where the U.S. economy stands and where inflation is heading?
Yeah, sure. I think that the headline GDP, right, it came in weaker than expected, 1.6%. The Atlanta Fed was looking for almost 3%. The median forecast in Bloomberg survey was 2.5%. But that number I take with a grain of salt, not just because it's subject to statistically significant revisions, but we know that ultimately the signal for growth and for the economy, we exclude three factors: inventories, trade, and U.S. government spending. And when you take those away, the U.S. economy, that would bring the U.S. economy well above 2% growth, much closer to the forecast. So I say that, and this is, remember what we saw in 2022, the first half, the U.S. economy contracted. It was because of trade and inventories. So I'd say that U.S. GDP in Q1 was stronger than the headline suggests. Trade was a weight, and inventories were still building, but at a slower pace than they did in Q4. So where do we sit? I'd say the economy is still growing above trend when you really look at how the Federal Reserve will look at it. And that might help explain why you have higher price pressures. The Federal Reserve says the economy, that the speed limit, the non-inflationary growth, is around 1.7, 1.8%. And when you make these allowances for government spending, for inventories, for trade, what we call final demand, final sales to domestic private purchasers, we have a stronger economy, which helps explain the inflation story. Now, I think that to me, the key, though, was that the GDP, the weakness in GDP, the headline weakness, came after the weakness that we saw in the services PMI. And the services PMI, the reason I bring that to your attention is that it showed an actual contraction in labor market. So to me, these are two strikes: weaker than expected GDP on the headline, and the weakness in the jobs component of the service PMI. So that really brings us into next week's U.S. jobs data. The market is looking at about 250,000 increase in non-farm payrolls. It'll be a solid number if we get that. On the other hand, I think the market's very vulnerable to a disappointing number. That would be like the third strike. Services ISM jobs, services PMI jobs, GDP. And then if we get a weak jobs number on next Friday, I think that we will see that the pendulum of market sentiment that has swung so hard, lifting our two-year note yield to 5%, that adjustment in expectations for Fed policy, I think, would have largely run its course if we see an unexpected weakness in next week's jobs report.
Well, Mark, let's bring inflation into this picture as well. In addition to the GDP being a little weaker and some of those job data points being a little weaker as we look ahead to next week's jobs report, the inflation readings for both headline and core on the PCE inflation deflator came in 1/10 above expectations. both headline and core, 2.7, 2.8%. So this kind of ties into a theme we've been seeing. It's saying a lot of the increase was due to the service sector, but we are still seeing raw materials, commodities going higher all month long in April. We've seen higher energy prices, oil. We've seen copper racing higher, aluminum. Some of that is due to the Russian sanction, but we've seen things like zinc, which has nothing to do with Russia, going higher. We've seen gold and silver doing well. Do you think that there's a bigger issue here with inflation than the market is paying attention to right now?
Interesting, Shed. I think that like ultimately when we think about inflation, though, it's not really about commodity prices. It's true what you say. A lot of commodity prices, metals, energy, even the average retail price of gasoline in the U.S. rising. So this will impact the headline measures of inflation, especially the energy components. But at the end of the day, I think that what's driving U.S. inflation right now is not commodities. It's shelter costs and maybe some healthcare costs as well. So I think that the rise in commodities, I think, has, of course, many causes. I don't want to suggest just one cause, but I would really focus much more on China, especially for the copper and aluminum. I would also think that, and there the story, I think, is not so much demand, but on supply, trying to rationalize, that is to cut back on production. I think Chile closed a copper mine as well. But when I think about inflation, the kind of inflation that Americans are experiencing, I don't think it's really coming from commodity prices. Even like the price of gold, I think we talked about this before. We can talk about why the large U.S. budget deficit or inflation in the U.S., but Americans don't seem to be buying that much gold. Well, Costco, of course, is beginning selling it. But I think that the real demand for gold is coming from China. It's not just the central bank, but it's Chinese people themselves who are looking for something to invest in. They can't really invest in the property market, and they don't have much confidence in the stock market, even though this week has been an incredibly strong week for Hong Kong stocks and Chinese stocks that trade, I should say the mainland stocks that trade in Hong Kong. It's been an incredible week for them. Just put that in perspective for you. And so in the past 5 days, the Hong Kong stock market is up about 8%, almost 9%, and those mainland stocks that trade in Hong Kong are up a little bit more than 9%. Chinese mainland investors going into Hong Kong to buy Chinese companies. And this is a huge move this past week. And I think they're the same story with gold. Chinese are buying gold. And it's not just a central bank. It's a lot of individuals that's really driven the price of Chinese gold above the global benchmarks. And that's partly because of the limited, the capital controls there in China.
Oh, we've been seeing a lot of demand out of the East for gold, but we have started to see a bit of demand, at least in the Western world here, for gold due to, I think, some of the, at least initial there, inflows into some of those ETFs. But Mark, on that inflation narrative, how important also is this ongoing wage growth, where it seems like wages have continued to rise, which do impact corporations' earnings and their profitability, and then also this deglobalization trend?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm a wage earner myself. I don't see wages really fueling inflation. I think most of our wage demands are coming after the fact in response to higher inflation, like cost of food going up, the price of energy going up. I need to have more to maintain the household. So I don't really think, I mean, so I think you're right that, two areas to be looking at for inflation pressures. One is wages. I think wage growth, when you look at it coupled with productivity growth, America, it's true that real wages in the U.S., unlike in most other major industrialized countries, real wages in the U.S., that's wages adjusted for inflation, are going up, but just a little bit. Profits, corporate profits, and we're in the middle of an earnings season now, but corporate profits are near record levels. By record levels, say record highest in a generation. And so I would think that shrinkflation, where companies reduce the size of their products or the weight of their products, charge the same amount. Corporate profitability, I think, is really more driving this. Opportunistically, for many years, businesses didn't have the pricing power, and now that they do, it's like a pedal to the metal. But I think ultimately, when the U.S. economy begins weakening, and that's why I think the jobs data is so important, when the economy begins weakening, I think we're going to see more downside pressure on prices. So I sort of still buy into the idea that prices are moderating, but the Fed's confidence has been shaken by these last couple of months' data. Even as a month ago, Powell was still talking about this bumpy path and didn't seem to be swayed very much by the latest prints. But I think that we're going to see a hawkish hold from the Fed next week, where the Fed stays pat and Powell explains about this setback in confidence. And, you know, when Federal Reserve officials talk about CPI, they often talk about not just 1 month at a time, but they're looking at 3 month and 6 month annualized rates. So there's going to be an echo. These recent higher than expected inflation readings will echo through for the next several months. So I'm in a camp that thinks that when the Federal Reserve does finally cut interest rates, it will do so because the economy is weakening more than inflation is at target.
Well, Mark, just as we look to that Fed meeting that's coming, and you mentioned the importance that they'll be placing on the labor markets and looking at the GDP figures that just came in, but also looking at some of these inflation data and some of the manufacturing data. Is there anything that you think would change the tone? Because, I mean, all of this data, if you take it all in context, is the bumpy ride that Powell's been talking about. He didn't say it was going to be a smooth ride. It's a bumpy ride. It's not that bumpy, really. There's not that crazy of inflation. There's not that crazy of GDP loss, or it didn't miss the mark by that much. And there's not that kind of crazy turbulence in the labor markets that would get them to do an about face. Are we expecting a nothing burger here, or is there anything that could change their tone?
I don't think that nothing in the next few days is going to change the tone. I think that we really will wait until we get the June summary of economic projections. And remember that we saw that in March, the Fed was talking about the possibility that is the out of the 19 FOMC members, 10 of them thought that there'd be three cuts or more this year, and the other nine thought two cuts or fewer. So I think that the pendulum, that sort of the pendulum has swung back and probably favors one at most two cuts this year. So we're going to see the sort of the dovish camp at the Fed converge with what had been the hawkish wing of it. I think there is talk of no cuts this year. I think it's a little bit early to anticipate, to think about a rate hike. I think that we really would need to see, I think, an acceleration of the economic activity and wage growth and a very strong labor number, employment number, to get the Fed, to get the market to really be thinking more about the Fed rate hike. I think that the, you know, we're talking about on a U.S. two-year note, 5% yield. We've been sort of straddling that area. We haven't closed above it. But I think a lot depends on next week's jobs data, whether we need to have a further adjustment in the two-year, say bring the two-year closer to 5.25% and bring the 10-year closer to 5%. I think, to me, that is what's data dependent. And I'm not sure we get there. And like I say, it all really hinges on a highly volatile economic report, U.S. jobs report.
So, Mark, what's going to drive markets here in the, let's say, midterm? Because we've seen rate cuts drop, anticipated rate cuts go lower and lower, and markets kept moving higher and higher. But then to start this month, we started to see some weakness, but some of that weakness is being bought back for markets after pretty much a 5 to 6 month run higher. What is truly driving these markets, and how are they staying, I guess, higher than some of the bears want to admit?
Yeah, isn't it interesting? You know, I've been away for the last couple of weeks, and I remember us talking a couple of weeks ago, and I was saying how the freight of the stock market, the S&Ps, were just booming. They exploded through that 5,000 level. We've fallen back below it, and yet that, I think, brought in more buyers. I think it's a situation in which higher interest rates come with because the economy is doing well, and companies have pricing power. And then when the economy weakens, the stock market does well because people say lower interest rates. So I don't know. My sense is that the market, that people want to buy stocks, and they took advantage of this pullback below 5,000 S&Ps to pour back into it or to add on. So I think that almost no matter what the scenario, people want to buy stocks. Either the economy is doing well or the Fed's going to be cutting interest rates. In either case, people see that as bullish. Like I say, we've seen the weakness of the yen has helped lift Japanese stocks, European stocks snapping a two-week slide this week. It seems to me we're still in a place where people are buying dips in equities and having a relatively healthy risk appetite despite the heightened geopolitical tensions and the heightened sense of uncertainty about Fed, not just Fed policy. You know, the market is now pricing out a Reserve Bank of Australia rate cut. The market scaling back rate cut possibilities in Europe. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting time. But my general sense is people want to buy stocks on a pullback. Risk appetites remain fairly healthy.
Sure seems like that. With higher interest rates, higher dollar, less rate cuts anticipated. It's crazy to see these markets just continuing to move higher. But clearly, I guess there's money out there and money lands in those markets. Mark, thank you very much for your time. We'll post a link to your website, Mark2Market, below this interview. Hopefully, we'll chat with you next week. Great having you back on the show, Mark. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks. Good luck to everybody.